Subcommittee on Civil Law is now in session. We are scheduled today to have a work session on two, House Bill 2043 and 2046. We will do 2046 first. This is a work session on both. We asked Mr. Chamoff to prepare some amendments that we requested on Monday at our previous hearing, and he has prepared two in alternate form. So I think I'd like to call Mr. Chamoff to come up and explain the alternate forms here to us.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Good morning. Greg Chamoff, Legislative Council. To begin with, let me explain what the amendments do not contain, which was Representative Shetterly's suggestion that we amend the first sentence of ORS 251-235 to make it clear that only a person who offered suggestions at a Secretary of State's hearing could seek review in the Supreme Court. After conferring with Mr. Breitlinger in my office, who's here today, and who handles the election law issues, and conferring with Representative Shetterly, we decided that it was best to leave that amendment out. The statute is written the way it is to permit somebody who liked the Secretary of State's statement, or the way it was, then someone came in and made a suggestion that the committee accepted and changed the statement in a way that made it unsuitable to the person who liked the original version. And it gives, as currently written, it gives the person who liked the original statement the opportunity to object to the revised statement. And so the way it's the statute is currently written is as expansive as it's supposed to be, and it would be a substantial departure from current practice to include the amendment that Representative Shetterly suggested, and that's why these amendments don't contain that language.
I'm satisfied. That is interesting. We hadn't thought of that. Although I still think, going back to our conversation on Monday, I think the assumption is that you have to have filed comments to review. I mean, that's I think a common assumption, but I do understand the reason that that is not, in fact, a rule. I'm satisfied with that.
Excuse me, Representative Lowe.
I apologize, Chair. Are you okay?
I'm fine. Go ahead.
Greg, is there elsewhere in this particular chapter a definition of service, or are we talking about ORCP 7 service?
Madam Chair, Representative Lowe, the latter.
Okay, and that's not mentioned here. An ordinary citizen reading this would say, oh, I got to serve this. Okay, here you are, bud. And then there's no proof of service or anything like that. And there's no formality of service or provable service. So do you think that it would be wise to make a reference to ORCP 7 or whatever kind of rule tells people what adequate service or proper service is? Because I think that more ordinary people will be using this than delve into the law books generally.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Lowe, I think that they can find whatever service requirements are necessary, either under the rules of civil procedure or rules of appellate procedure, but we could certainly include a reference to that in line 15 as an explanation of the means of service.
Madam Chairman, I would like it very much if you would do that, because I think that ordinary people would feel upset if they were if their service was challenged or their explanation was challenged based upon failure to do proper service. They'd feel like the legal authorities in the state had bushwhacked them. So let's just let them know right up front what the service requirements are.
Madam Chair?
Ms. Shetterly.
I'm not opposed to that. I don't want to make this any more difficult than we need to, but Would it be governed by ORCP or would it be the Oregon Rules of Appellate? You mentioned that. It would be one or the other, wouldn't it?
Madam Chair, Representative Sherrod, I believe it would be the Rules of Appellate Procedure, but Mr. Swank would be more likely to know the answer to that than I.
And Brad is nodding his head yes. I'm just...
Either that it's more likely he knows or it's the Oregon Rules of Appellate Procedure.
You want me to have him come up?
Sure.
Mr. Swank, would you come forward, please? Thank
you. Good morning. For the record, my name is Brad Swank. I'm with the State Court Administrator's Office. If it's not something that's specified in the statute, it would be something that would be procedural and would be covered by the Oregon Rules of Appellate Procedure because we'd be going to the Supreme Court.
Well, yeah, in that case, I'm not sure that we need to incorporate that because, for one thing, the Rules of Appellate Procedure are not statutory. They're the rules of the court. Right? I mean, we don't, yeah. And I think anybody then who's going to be filing a petition in the Supreme Court
better know what they're doing.
Yeah, ought to be looking at the rules of procedure for Supreme Court, and there will be the rules regarding filing and service of petitions.
I can just see all these people that... Excuse me for the informality.
That's all right, Representative Lowe.
I can just see all the people that file all those initiatives without assistance of counsel or aid, taking objection to the explanatory statement and saying, well, okay... But I guess you're right. I cannot perceive that they would stand before the Supreme Court without somebody's assistance. So I'll withdraw my concern. You've convinced me. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Swank.
Madam Chair, if we could retain Mr. Swank here for a moment.
Right.
The other significant issue, the difference between the Dash 1 and the Dash 2 amendments are in the Dash 2s, based on language that Mr. Swank has suggested, you would be adding a fairly specific explanation of the consequences of failing to file and serve the petition in a timely manner. Normally, in our statutes, the consequences of failing to file are left implicit. However, in this circumstance, given the concern that it would be individual citizens rather than more sophisticated litigants using these statutes, we have before you at least a suggestion that would spell out somewhat clearly what would happen if you're late. And we don't have a position one way or the other on which way of informing potential petitioners of the consequences of their lateness is. We just present them both to you for your policy choice.
Thank you. Any questions?
Madam Chair?
Yes?
Well, not a question, but now I do see one concern raised by the addition of service requirement in line 8, and this relates either to whether the consequence of failing to file and serve is explicit or implicit. Where we have the service request, it's one thing to file within 5 days. I am concerned that what we've done is we've also required service within 5 days. And that doesn't bother me so much where service is required on the Attorney General, for instance. He's always going to be easy to find, or at least make office service. But where you've also got to serve members of the Explanatory Statement Committee and chief petitioners, and we've got a 5-day time frame for filing and service, I'm wondering if we're creating too narrow a window here where you're looking for individuals potentially around the state or who, having finished their arduous task in the Explanatory Statement Committee, may have taken off for Cabo San Lucas for a week. And that service may be hard to come by in 5 days if we create that as a jurisdictional step as a condition of even hearing this. I don't know. I should have thought of this on Monday, but now that I see it in front of us, I'd be curious what the witnesses think about that. Normally, for instance, in the rules of procedure, you have, of course, it's different at the appellate level, but then you've got already people of record in the trial court whose addresses are there and service can be made at those addresses. But to initiate a petition, normally you have the filing date and then time within within a certain time after that to conclude your service. And I'm curious to know what the witnesses think about that.
Chair Walker, Representative Shetterly, actually, that's a legitimate point. These time frames are short because you've got somebody who's challenging something that's headed to be printed by the Secretary of State. We certainly don't argue that. Excuse me, my voice is not quite awake in the morning.
I remember.
It can be rushed. Our whole contention is if you choose to make it jurisdictional, the consequences should be clear. That failure to do it precludes a Supreme Court review. If you choose to make it at a later time, those consequences should be clear also. We think it's a policy decision. The reason I'm here is just to make sure that the consequences are clear and the procedures as clear as we can get it.
I think, Representative Shetterly, what I see here is that the time frames are so short and you're dealing with trying to get something in the ballot measure pamphlet that people who are concerned with this issue are going to be watching. They're not going to go to Campbellsville Lucas, I don't think. But in other words, they're going to be relatively informed on the issue. They're going to be watching what happens to that title.
If I may.
Yes.
Madam Chair. I don't know. Your petition, your explanatory statement committee of people sometimes just, they're not going to be the ones filing this, so they don't care about the 5 days, for one thing. The obligation is on the person challenging to make the service, not on the person
right.
who is on the committee or the chief petitioner
right.
to be available for service. And so there's no particular reason for them to be available if they don't want to be sued or challenged. There's no particular reason for them to even make themselves available or amenable to service. And that's a pretty short time frame on a party who wants to make a challenge. I don't know, Greg, would you?
Madam Chair, Representative Shetterly, my expectation would be that the Supreme Court would prescribe a means of service that would take into account the short time frame, and that perhaps under the circumstances, simply mailing the notice at the time you file the petition, as you do when you file a petition for review or any other kind of document seeking Supreme Court review, would be sufficient.
What's the time frame for when the response has to be in? So I'm wondering how much time, if we delayed service by another 5 days or something, what's the turnaround time need to be?
I don't have that. That, again, is set by Supreme Court rule for these, and they'd have to take that into consideration about their time frame and what they were going to do, and I can't tell you what they would do with that. There is an Oregon Rules of Appellate Procedure Committee that meets to review those kinds of things and to make suggestions about how to set out those time frames.
Because one option would be you have to file the challenge within 5 days, and you have to have completed service within 10 or something like that. Then you're still getting the person notice in time to respond to the challenge. But I do see a problem. For example, I think it's important to serve the chief petitioner, but that person may not have an office. I mean, they may be more difficult to serve than the attorney general, for example.
Any other questions? Representative Shetterly.
Could you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Well,
I can hear you
maybe,
thinking.
No, maybe Mr. Chamov has a satisfactory answer there, that if we just say served, then the Supreme Court by rule can establish what constitutes service for the purpose of this petition. And if that be, the mailing address of the chief petitioner and the members of the explanatory committee on the on the records of the Secretary of State's office, because I'd assume they would all be there, then the Supreme Court really can cover this. I guess if we don't say how that service is to be done, why then we do leave that to the Supreme Court. And Mr. Swank is here, and he can go back and take a look at the rules of appellate procedure, and if they don't address this, they can be amended to address this. That'd be satisfactory to me.
Okay. And changed then? Okay.
Right. And Chair, there is one other change that needs to be made to the amendments, regardless of which ones you choose. In the -1 amendments, you should strike lines 6 and 7, and in the -2 amendments, you should strike lines 8 and 9. That was a brilliant idea that I had for eliminating language that I thought was no longer necessary under the circumstances after our discussion with Representative Shetterly, but that Mr. Reitlinger has assured me is in fact necessary and should stay in the bill.
Line 9, correct?
Madam Chair, lines 8 and 9 of the -2 amendments,
mm-hmm.
and lines 6 and 7 of the -1 amendments, so that the difference between the two amendments still remains the change in line 10 of the bill, whether to specifically prescribe what the consequences of untimely filing and service are.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Shetterly.
I would move the -2 amendments into House Bill 2046. It seems to me we may as well be explicit as to the consequences of failure to file so that everybody is clear what the rules are when they look at the statute.
Okay. Question? Okay. Any objection? Hearing none.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'd move House Bill 2046 as... Oh, maybe for the record, if I can clarify that last motion, that was the -2 amendments without lines 8 and 9.
Please respect.
Been deleted. Then I would move House Bill 2046 as amended by the -2 amendments, but not including lines 8 and 9 of the -2 amendments, to the full committee.
Comment.
Yes, Representative Bell.
Line 8 includes a partial sentence. Do we need to make it clear?
No, line 8 and 9 of the -2 amendments.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
This would be
a... Never mind.
Yep.
She reminds for one day.
That's all right. That's okay.
Certainly.
All right. Everyone understand that motion? Okay. Any objection? Hearing none. Pass to the full committee.
What rhymes with explanatory statement?
I might be here a long time. Okay, House Bill 2043, work session. Everyone has a copy of the amendment to the bill? Okay.
Madam Chair, is there another copy of the bill handy? I don't.
Yes, Representative Ringo needs a copy of the bill.
Not having yet.
Oh, here, I've got an extra.
Oh.
Oh, thank you.
We're covered. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks.
Okay. Mr. Chamov, would you come forward, please? We have an amendment prepared for us.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Good morning. Greg Chamod, Legislative Council. Hopefully these amendments do just what you wanted them to do. In Section 2 of the bill, it adds the governor to the list of officials for whom the Legislative Council can provide drafting services.
Mr. Chamoff?
Yes.
We're having difficulty hearing you. We have some machinery or something operating outside the window, so would you speak up a little bit so we can hear you?
Yes, Madam Chair. The first change in the bill is in Section 2, where we add the governor to the list of officials who may request drafting services from the Legislative Council. In Section 4 of the bill, we've added the provision suggested by Representative Shetterly to provide that the Legislative Council's providing a copy of a draft measure to one of the other legislative service agency directors does not constitute a waiver of attorney-client privilege. And in the last section of the bill, we have removed the repeal of 173.140, which was the 50 signatures, and you can get our help with an initiative petition statute.
Any questions of Mr. Chamberlain on the amendments?
Madam Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
I would move the dash one amendments to House Bill 2043.
Any objection? Hearing none. Accepted. I'll entertain a motion on House Bill 2043.
Madam Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
House Bill 2043 to the full committee. As amended.
As amended. Thank you. Any objection? Hearing none. Pass the full committee. House Bill 2043.
Well, you run a mean gavel.
Okay. House Judiciary Subcommittee on Civil Law is hereby closed.
You know, that global reminds me of the last session.